We have no reason to believe that human error was involved. We just don't know.
BP gets control of a leaking well, but it's not yet clear why it happened. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists describe a rare case of river piracy, where one river steals the flow of another.
Nobody's documented this as basically occurring under our noses.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
BP announced today that a leak from one of its North Slope production wells was stopped at 3:35 a.m. State regulators don't yet have an estimate for how much oil and gas was released from the well. The cause of the incident is still unknown. The well was spewing both gas and crude oil when BP first noticed the leak on Friday morning. State and federal regulators say the well stopped spraying oil on Saturday. The well continued venting natural gas until it was killed Monday morning by pumping salt water down the hole. The initial response took place during the challenging weather conditions, according to Suzanne Skadowski with the Environmental Protection Agency.
It has continued to be very cold, and there have been pretty significant winds, 20 to 30 miles an hour, upwards of 40 and 50 miles an hour.
But Skadowski says the main challenge was the well itself. Two separate leaks had formed, and the well had risen 3 to 4 feet out of the ground. This caused a pressure gauge to break off, which hindered efforts to kill the well. BP employees were forced to leave the pad during the incident. No injuries were reported. Regulators are investigating the leak's impact on the environment, but an initial overflight indicated the crude spray didn't reach the nearby tundra. Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission Chair Kathy Forrester says her agency will observe the leak investigation, but there's not yet any evidence that BP did something wrong.
We have no reason to believe that BP did anything that was regulatorily non-compliant. We have no reason to believe that human error was involved. We just don't know.
Forrester says at the time of the incident, the well was producing about 300 barrels of oil per day. The well is located about 5 miles from the Dead Horse Airport, and the nearest community, New Ixit, is approximately 50 miles west of the pad. A man is in custody after Alaska State Troopers say he fired shots and threatened people with a hammer near the Seward Highway this morning. Troopers identified him as Nathaniel R. Smith of Anchorage. The highway was closed for about 2 hours south of Girdwood. Troopers say Smith was first reported as a drunk driver a little after 8 a.m., and he subsequently wrecked his pickup. Then troopers say multiple callers to 911 reported Smith was threatening people on the road with a hammer and a handgun, which he allegedly fired at one point. Smith allegedly fled into the woods along the highway near mile 76, and troopers say they guided him out after calling his mobile phone. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says there were no injuries. Peters says troopers had no choice but to close down the highway until the man was caught.
When you have somebody with a firearm and there's reports that shots are being fired, there is a concern that public safety is at risk. Fortunately, we were able to end the situation peacefully.
It was less than 2 weeks ago that troopers closed the Seward Highway at Beluga Point, a popular Cook Inlet viewing spot near Anchorage, for 12 hours due to a man who had fired shots. He was later found dead. In the incident on Monday, today, troopers say Smith was uninjured. He now faces assault. Troopers ask that anyone who witnessed the incident call them to make a report. Vice President Mike Pence stopped in Anchorage on Saturday and met with Governor Bill Walker. Walker says they talked about Alaska's trade relations in Asia. Walker spoke about developing the state's natural resources for foreign and domestic use. Walker and Pence also discussed the state's strategic location for military operations. And Walker raised the importance of the Essential Air Service program to Alaska. Alaska Gasline Development Corporation President Keith Meyer joined Walker in the meeting. Pence stopped in Alaska while his plane refueled on the way to South Korea. Scientists are pointing to climate change as the reason a river that used to feed into the Yukon has nearly disappeared. A report published in Nature Geoscience Today says it's the first documented case of river piracy in modern times linked to the planet heating up. River piracy is when one river steals the flow of another. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins explains.
Scientists knew the Kaskawalsh Glacier in northern Canada was shrinking, but they didn't expect it to cause a nearby lake to almost vanish, at least not so quickly.
Nobody's documented this as basically occurring under our noses.
Dan Sugar researches how landforms evolve at the University of Washington, Tacoma. And last fall, he set out with his colleagues to study the Slims River. It's fed by a series of ponds at the front of the Kaskawalsh Glacier. When he arrived, Sugar says he expected the river's current to be low.
But as it turned out, it was essentially no flow. So we couldn't actually do it. We couldn't put our instruments in the water. It was so shallow.
Did you have a nice vacation then?
Sugar
didn't spend the remainder of his time in Canada kicking back. His new mission became figuring out what happened to the Slims River. The body of water used to flow into the Kluane Lake and eventually into the Yukon River, which empties into the Bering Sea. But because of the glacier's melt, that water redirected.
The Kaskawalsh River essentially stole all of the water that would have otherwise flowed into the Slims River. So it pirated that flow. It captured that flow.
Now that water goes from the Kaskawalsh River to the Alsik River and all the way to the Gulf of Alaska, Sugar says due to the circumstances, this particular situation is unique. Still, the rapid pace at which it occurred serves as an important reminder.
Climate change is happening, and it's happening here. So we need to be keeping in mind that we may get thrown a few curveballs going forward.
So while the Kaskawalsh River was the pirate, Sugar says human-caused climate change was ultimately to blame. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the House passes an income tax, but not all members were happy about it.
Let's call this for what it is. It is income redistribution. It's taking from the haves and giving to the have-nots.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The House passed a bill on Saturday that would bring a state income tax to Alaska for the first time in 37 years. The vote sends it to the Senate, where leaders oppose the tax. Dillingham Democratic House Speaker Bryce Edgman says the Education Funding Act is needed to prevent rural communities from suffering.
The way I view it, we do a partial plan this year. We're going to cut the like amount next year and probably the year after. And we really are going to see a lot of schools shutting down. Where are those students going to go? That'll be the question for tomorrow.
A single person with no children earning $40,000 a year would pay $600 under the tax. A married couple with two children and $100,000 in income would pay $1,500. Eagle River Republican Representative Dan Sadler says the tax would harm the private sector.
Let's call this for what it is. It is income redistribution. It's taking from the haves and giving to the have-nots.
Governor Bill Walker praised the House for passing the bill as part of a plan to balance the budget. The tax would close a quarter of the gap between what the state spends and what it raises. But the bill faces a difficult path in the upper chamber. Senate President Pete Kelly says it will receive a fair hearing, but he also says the idea of taxing working Alaskans during a recession is absurd on its face. Today, Kelly referred the bill to the Senate Labor and Commerce and Finance Committees. The legislature has gone past the deadline set under state law to finish the annual session, and there are few signs that they'll be finishing their work soon. Today was the 91st day of the session, which is scheduled to last 90 days, although the state constitution allows for 121 days. The Senate and House haven't yet named the six members of conference committees to resolve differences over the operating budget and a plan to draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. Instead of making announcements on major bills, the two chambers passed smaller legislation. One example is Senate Bill 80, which allows state regulators to charge cell phone owners a new monthly fee. The money would be used to pay for communication devices and software for people who are deaf or hard of hearing or who have a speech disability. Anchorage Senator Mia Costello says the bill is a consequence of many residents moving to mobile phones, including her own family.
We hardly use our landline, and many families in Alaska now solely use a cell phone.
Currently, residents' landlines are charged 9 cents per month to fund services for those with disabilities, while business lines are charged 18 cents per month. Costello says the Regulatory Commission of Alaska expects to charge cell phone users 5 cents a month if the bill is enacted. Costello says the number of Alaskans who have landlines is only 47% of what it was when the fees were started. She says the bill expands the number of people who will benefit from the program while costing cell phone users only 60 cents per year.
This is an important bill because it looks to the 21st century in updating the type of technology that hearing impaired Alaskans will be able to use.
All 19 senators who were present voted for the bill. It now heads to the House. The Securities and Exchange Commission filed a complaint late last week that alleged insider trading in the purchase of GCI by a Colorado-based company. The 13-page complaint lays out a timeline of rapid purchases of high-risk GCI stock options 2 weeks before it was announced the company would be acquired by Liberty Interactive Corporation. In a filing with the U.S. District Court in Southern New York, the SEC says the defendants are one or more unnamed stock traders believed to be based in the United Kingdom or Lebanon. The insider trading charges are connected with the activity of two financial service companies that bought $48,000 worth of GCI stock in a two-week window at the end of March. Neither company, UK-based Nomura or Lebanon-based Cedrus, has traded GCI stock in the previous 6 months. As a result, when the value of GCI stock grew by 62% on the day the acquisition was announced, those risky holdings became worth more than $1 million. The SEC says the timing, size, and profitability of the trades is highly suspicious, and it believes non-public information about the proposed sale was exchanged in the lead-up. The SEC declined to comment beyond what was laid out in court documents. Neither Nomura or Cedrus replied to a request for comment. GCI spokesperson Heather Handyside also declined to comment. The allegations don't appear to have any effect on GCI customers in Alaska or on the status of Liberty's acquisition, which is expected to be finalized before the end of the year. 80% of the world's emperor goose population breeds on a 10-mile strip that runs from Koniginik up the coast of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to Hooper Bay. This year, for the first time in 30 years, federal managers have opened a subsistence hunt for the birds. The geese haven't migrated to the Delta yet, and in this report from KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur, we learn that the feds are trying to encourage conservative hunting of the vulnerable species before they get here.
With the season opening for emperor geese for the first time in 30 years, there is a concern of overharvest of emperor geese because they're ignorant to a lot of hunting activities because they haven't been harvested, so they haven't learned to avoid hunters.
That's Brian Daniels, a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says the point is to hunt the birds conservatively so they won't have to close the hunt again. Here are four suggestions to prevent overharvesting emperor geese and to keep the population growing. Limit how many birds a hunter takes. Only take juvenile birds with dark heads as opposed to adult birds with white heads that could be breeding. Target one bird at a time instead of spraying the flock, and only take one or two eggs from a nest. That's the information managers are trying to get out to the coastal villages before the birds land on the Delta. Except Friday, they ran into a problem.
So you're grounded right now?
Yeah, currently the fog here in Bethel has us grounded from flying out to Hooper Bay. for outreach activities.
Instead of being on that plane, Brian Daniels was sitting in his office at the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge building in Bethel. This month, he's traveling to 6 YK Delta communities to ask hunters to take it easy on the emperor geese.
I went to Chivac on Wednesday the 12th. I'm supposed to be going to Hooper Bay today, Chifornik on Monday, April 17th, Tuksuk Bay on April 19th, Nightmute on April 21st, and Newtok on April 28th.
With the fog, Daniels never made it to Hooper Bay. That visit has been rescheduled to Tuesday, April 18th, tomorrow. At the villages, Daniels and a Yupik-speaking U.S. Fish and Wildlife staff member present a PowerPoint in Yupik and English to the tribal council. Their message?
Hunt conservatively this year so we can continue hunting them in the future and we never have to close it again.
In the mid-1980s, the emperor goose population dropped dangerously low. And since then, hunters have abstained from harvesting them to allow the population to grow. Now the population is just above the threshold to sustain a hunt, and managers like biologist Brian Daniels are encouraging a conservative approach during this first season. Along with being unaccustomed to being hunted, emperor geese have behaviors that make them vulnerable to overharvest. Like when one is shot, the family members will circle the fallen bird instead of flying away, making them easy targets. Also, the birds lay eggs later in life and don't lay every year, and the rates for the birds living past their first year are lower than other geese species. To help managers like Daniels see how the harvest goes, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is hiring one person from each of the 6 coastal communities they're visiting to collect data.
There's no personal information written on the data sheet. Basically just the village that you're from, the date, how many emperor geese you've harvested, and then we try to get the age, whether it's an adult or juvenile, the gender of the goose and the weight of the goose.
The position runs about 6 weeks from now until the beginning of June. The emperor geese are expected to arrive on the YK Delta in mid to late May. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The University of Alaska is moving forward on Title IX initiatives stipulated under an agreement with the Federal Office of Civil Rights to correct past mishandling of sexual assault and other offenses. Recently hired University of Alaska Fairbanks Office of Diversity and Equal Opportunity Director Margot Griffith says the office is disseminating information to help victims.
Resources that they can reference that give them clear information and that those resources are easily available and easy to find.
Griffith says the information and outreach efforts are being developed through consultations within and outside the university community. Other UAF actions include filing a second case investigator position as well as hiring a case manager.
And that position will communicate quite frequently with individuals that may have complaints or have questions about the Title IX process. And we didn't have that before. That was a big piece of the communication that was missing.
Griffith says there are deadlines to the agreement with the Federal Office of Civil Rights, including May 1st, when updated policy and regulation documents are due. While it wasn't on the agenda, the Ketchikan School Board got a lesson last week about tenure, taught by 5 of the district's tenured teachers. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
During their March 22nd school board meeting, members talked about the state's statutes regarding tenure. School board president Trevor Shaw said he'd vote against renewing contracts for the district's tenured teachers because he doesn't like the state law. Because of his no vote, 2 abstentions, and 1 absence, the contract renewal initially failed. Shaw did bring the motion back for reconsideration, and it ended up passing unanimously. The teachers who spoke during public comment were not happy with the tone of that March 22 discussion. Frankie Urquhart is a science teacher at Schoenbar Middle School. She says that if board members have a problem with state law, they shouldn't use their employees' contracts to make a statement.
If you gentlemen think that the state of Alaska is going to take notice of a school board president who votes to not offer tenure teacher contracts or a few members of a school board who don't like how the state handles them, you are wrong. But you do know who did take notice of this debate, the tenured teachers in this district.
Shaw stressed repeatedly during the March 22 discussion that he wasn't criticizing any of the teachers on the tenured contract list, and he wanted all of them to receive contracts. But during the discussion, Shaw also stated that tenure is an arcane process, and he questioned whether it was still needed. Board member Kim Hodney, who was one of the initial abstaining votes, called tenure a golden ticket, and board member Matt Eisenhower, who voted yes both times to approve the contracts, questioned the state process, which calls for tenure after 3 years of teaching in a district. He said tenure should mean more than a rubber stamp. Urquhart addressed some of the comments made by each of those members, and at one point, Shaw tried to stop her.
I am offended and feel disrespected by your uneducated remarks regarding teacher tenure.
Ms. Urquhart, we're
here's
not
what teacher tenure,
no,
this is public
going,
comment. I
not,
think I'm allowed
Ms.
to
Urquhart,
speak.
Ms. Urquhart, we are not going to question the personal intentions of board members.
You know what, sir? I am in public comment. I am a teacher. I'm a tenured teacher. I'm going to speak.
Urquhart and the other teachers who spoke said that tenure is not a rubber stamp. The 3-year evaluation process is rigorous and gives plenty of time for the district to know whether a teacher deserves tenure, and that tenured teachers can be dismissed for various reasons. They also said that tenure protects teachers from getting dismissed for no reason or to save money by firing experienced educators in favor of new teachers who start at a lower salary level. Jerry Davis is a tenured teacher and president of the Ketchikan Education Association. She says tenure protects academic freedom, maintains talent in the school district, and allows teachers to fully participate in the community, including publicly expressing opinions.
Non-tenured teachers may be non-retained for any cause that the employer deems adequate. This is why you won't see any non-tenured teachers speaking here tonight.
The primary issue board members had with the state regulation is what they considered a lack of a local voice in the tenure process. Even if the board had not approved the tenure teacher contracts, they would have renewed automatically in mid-May. Following public comment, Shaw and Eisenhower thanked the teachers for their comments and their contribution to the discussion. While Hodney also said he appreciated the speaker's passion, he took issue with some of the criticism. Hodney says he comes from a family of educators and he understands the importance of tenure.
There has never been another opportunity prior to that night, unfortunately, to have a conversation about tenure. The contracts were not in jeopardy. They were passed. It did happen. At some point, we have to have a conversation. It's not a conversation about dropping tenure, period. Nobody wants to do away with tenure. That was never a part of the conversation. I respect tenure, and I believe the bar needs raised on tenure. That's all.
During that March 22nd meeting, the other board members present were Diane Gubitayo, Misty Brown, and Alma Parker. Brown and Parker voted in favor of the tenured contracts both times while still expressing concern about the state's tenure regulations. Gubitayo abstained both times and didn't participate in the debate because her daughter is a teacher. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Competition was tough and quick during the UPIC Spelling Bee this weekend in Anchorage. Johanna Yurick reports that even with 4 schools from 2 school districts, competition quickly became a battle between the former champ from Newnham Iqua and contenders in Kotlik.
Daniel Hunter, last year's champion from Newnham Iqua, was in the room when his coach, Savannah Strongheart, took the microphone Saturday to get the competition started.
Koyana Dailuchi, welcome to UPIC Spelling Bee for Beginners Statewide Spelling Bee, the final spelling bee for the season.
Everyone knew he was the one to beat, but 2 things quickly became apparent. Spelling in UPIC is a lot harder than spelling in English. Bearing witness was one contestant who did not place in Saturday's Anchorage competition, but earlier came in 4th in the statewide English spelling bee. The UPIC alphabet may have only 16 letters compared to 26 in English, but there are some tough rules and things that sound kind of close. Savannah Strongheart.
Oh, even I have trouble with it. So there's the G and R and the Q and K. Even I have trouble with those.
Kewlik. Kewlik.
The first word in the spelling bee for beginners had almost everyone stumped.
Kuiglik. Q-U-I-G-L-I-K. Kuiglik.
Kuiana.
Kuiana is something you don't want to hear in a Yupik spelling bee. It means thank you. What you want to hear is Akzaktuk, and we didn't get to hear that on the first word until we got through more than half the contestants to Lucy Prince, a speller from Kotlik.
Q-I-G-L-I-Q.
Prince wasn't even in the room. The three spellers from Kotlik were weathered in and participating via the internet. But that did not stop them from spelling, though it made it tougher on them to hear the exact pronunciation of the word. And at one point, the technology threw a ringer at Madison Oktikon in Kotlik.
Ingrid.
The frozen network interruption did not stop Madison, who got it right.
I-N-G-R-I-Q.
There is more at stake here than spelling. Every adult involved says learning the Yupik language is about identity and culture. Frida Dan, the event's founder and organizer, grew up without speaking Yupik because her parents wanted her to concentrate on English and do well in school. She became another statistic in what was a prevalent belief at the time that knowing other languages would interfere with learning English. But now there's a lot of evidence that multilingual students do better over the long run. For Dan, who worked to relearn her language as an adult, the issue became how to make sure her children could speak and read Yupik. That's when she decided to organize a Yupik spelling bee.
Ironically, by the time I got it going, none of my kids or something or another would make so that they couldn't be in the spelling bee.
It may have taken her a while to organize that first Yupik spelling bee, but Saturday, it did not take much time to find the winners.
Makarok, M-A-Q-A-R-U-A-Q, Makarok.
It took only six words to narrow the competition. Daniel Hunter was in the room and Lucy Prince and Madison Oktikon, two contestants in Kotlik. Third place went to Lucy Prince and second to Madison Oktikon, both from Kotlik. And the first place went to Daniel Hunter from Nunavik. If there's any question about the connection of language to identity, just look at the winner of this year's Yupik Spelling Bee. He began by learning the Yupik alphabet and speaking Yupik in school last year and won the Spelling Bee in his first year. Now he's back doing the same again with admittedly tougher competition. But it is what he's doing outside of school that underscores the importance of the language to culture and identity. Daniel has joined the Nunam Ikwa traditional dance group.
Do Eskimo dance, I'd want to go down. And the way I recognize the songs is like memorize the words and the moves.
In the words of his coach, Daniel loves to sing in Yupik. This is Johanna Urich.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Casey Grove, Zachariah Hughes, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.